WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air, and joining me in the studio now is Steve Schick and guests. Steve is the co-producer of a news magazine called Consider the Alternatives, which can be heard on WUHY every Monday evening at 10 o'clock.
Good afternoon. In the next half hour, we'll be talking with John McAuliffe and Sophie Quinn Judge about a topic that has all but faded from the American consciousness, even in this election year. We'll be talking about Vietnam. That's almost a word that isn't heard anymore. Both Sophie and John were in Vietnam at the time of its liberation last year, John in Hanoi and Sophie in Saigon. And before we talk about what's happened in the year that's just about past now, we'd like to get some impressions, recollections of what it was like both in Hanoi and in Saigon at the time of the last Americans leaving Vietnam. Sophie, could you give us a feeling of what was happening almost a year ago now?
Well, it was a very frightening time. People in Saigon weren't sure what was going to be happening. We weren't sure that the Saigon government would surrender. And when it finally did on the morning of April 30th, it was just a tremendous feeling of relief that the war was over, that there wasn't going to be a battle for Saigon.
What were you doing in Saigon? Maybe you could give us a little bit of background there.
Well, my husband and I were the Saigon representatives for the American Friends Service Committee. The service committee had a rehabilitation project upcountry in Quang Nai province, and we were doing support work, buying supplies in Saigon.
Mm-hmm. Was there, the people that you were working with, where did they fall in, I guess what I would say, in a political spectrum? In other words, what kind of feelings, from what kind of people were you getting your feelings from? Who were they, and how were they involved politically, if they were at all?
Well, we worked and had contact with a very varied group of people, from civil servants in the Ministry of Health to our fairly anti-communist cook to students who were, if not overtly, supporters of the Provisional Revolutionary Government. They were very sympathetic. So I think we had a pretty balanced view of what was happening in Saigon.
Was there a great fear at that time of what this year now that's passed would bring as far as their own recriminations, bloodbath, which was loudly touted by the administration for, well, almost a decade, that if we didn't support Saigon, the bloodbath would come. Was there a great feeling that that this year would bring that?
Well, there was a lot of fear, especially in the last days before the war ended, because stories about the bloodbath had been spread around to such a large degree by the Saigon government through its press and TV and also by the U.S. Embassy. But for the average Saigonese, I don't think it took terribly long for them to realize once the war was over that there wasn't going to be a bloodbath, that the new soldiers that came into Saigon weren't interested in, you know, in raping or pillaging. Mm-hmm. They were, in fact, amazingly well-behaved. And of course, there were still people when we left 3 months later who were very cynical about the communists, who were saying, just wait, in 3 more months it's all going to start happening. You know, you'll see the repression beginning. But that was a very small group of people, I think, just those who were sort of anti-communists at a very gut level.
Most of those who really believed that perhaps were evacuated. Or at least those
a good number, anyway.
John, what were you doing in Hanoi at that time a year ago?
I was visiting with a delegation from the Coalition to Stop Funding the War. There were 4 or 5 of us from different parts of the country, and it was just one of those trips that, from time to time, groups of Americans have made to ascertain the situation in North Vietnam and to understand better their perceptions of what was happening with the war.
It wasn't exactly coincidence, was it?
Well, we were We were leaving in the last days of the war. We delayed our departure a week, in fact, because we were afraid that the U.S. was going to reintervene and that it was a bad time for us to be gone because of the organizational roles we played. But finally, we figured, well, we should go. But we were out of touch, out of communication for several days, and we had no idea as we were arriving in Hanoi that everything was ending in Saigon. We were told very quietly and very low-key when we arrived at the airport that Graham Martin had left Saigon that morning. And it was about in that tone of voice.
Right?
And it didn't really penetrate what that meant. And then a little later, we were told while still at the airport that the last Americans had left Saigon and that the presidential palace had been captured by the liberation forces. And then later in the afternoon, when the word was announced publicly in Hanoi, it was just a very happy time, very informal, low-key. It wasn't a Flyers victory celebration or what the newsreels tell us about VJ Day or VE Day. It was just families on the street, school orchestras or groups of people from a workplace, but no overall organization except to put out some banners and so on. Lots of firecrackers, an incredible fireworks display in the evening. The remarkable thing was this was less than 2.5 years after the Christmas bombing, the terror bombing of Hanoi, and there was no sense of hostility towards any of us as Americans. In fact, it was just the opposite. We were very warmly welcomed, not simply by the government officials who deal with Americans regularly, but by people on the street. I spent much of that first afternoon just running around like a crazy man with a camera and a tape recorder and trying to soak in everything and record everything. And I was hauled up in the back of a dump truck that was full of young men, half of whom were soldiers. And I knew the only word I knew in Vietnamese was American, and I said that's who I was. And there was never any sign of hostility. There was just friendliness and the sort of an embarrassed good humor because we couldn't communicate at all with each other. But it was a it meant tremendously deep things to all of the Americans who were there, and it obviously meant tremendously to the Vietnamese. It was the first time in a generation, the first time in many of their lives, that their country hadn't been at war for its independence. It was funny, though, for the other foreigners, the other Western Europeans from Western and Eastern Europe, who were in Hanoi at the same time, Swedes or East Germans or whoever, it didn't mean nearly the same thing. They just couldn't understand why people weren't celebrating more or something like that. That question never occurred to us because we just felt the same mixture of relief and joy that the country had finally was at peace and that finally the outside intervention of our own government had stopped.
Well, it's amazing. It's amazing now sitting here thinking that it's been a year. And to think how little attention now on this anniversary is really given to an event that has preoccupied our nation for over a decade. So little concern in reflecting on that as a celebration should, as a reconsideration of what it was Vietnam was about and what Americans learned or didn't learn from that experience. In looking over this year, Sophie, part of which you were in Vietnam 3 months after the final evacuation of the last American, what stands out in your mind as in Vietnam as having changed? I mean, obviously there's a new government, but and I guess I'm talking. I would like to get a feeling of feelings of attitudes, if you can convey that.
It's really difficult to describe the feelings in Saigon because the situation was at one time very much the same as it had been, and at the same time very different. People's everyday lives in many cases hadn't changed that much. Women who worked in the market, who sold food in the market, went back to the market 2 days or so after the war ended and carried on as before. Even civil servants in many cases went back to their old jobs. The government made an effort to make the transition as smooth as possible and to reassure people by just assuring the continuity of their daily lives. The biggest change, of course, is that peace has come. It's very obvious, but oftentimes you don't realize all the different ramifications that has for people. For a start, young men are free for the first time to consider careers, building their lives. We heard from one friend that he went to 5 weddings, for example, in the first week after the war ended, because people were suddenly
sounds like a good
paying attention
to
their personal lives.
How about all the AFSC babies 9 months after the war ended?
Right. It has the same effect over here. The parents who had to pay bribes to keep their sons out of the army, for example, are no longer doing that. Then there were the political prisoners who were reunited with their families after 5-10 years. And on top of that, all the families that had been separated by the split that came about when the Geneva Agreements were signed in 1954. There were just countless families that had been separated out of touch for 20, 21 mm-hmm. years, and they were gradually getting back together again.
Mm-hmm. That division came into existence, the demarcation line, which was political demarcation in 54, is now going to be removed once and for all, as I understand, very shortly. In fact, on the 25th, there having been an election for an assembly and so forth in Vietnam, no longer will we be talking about North and South Vietnam. John, what is the state of that reunification? I recall not long ago, it was during the war, I guess, but the provisional government in Saigon always being very hesitant to project or to talk about reunification for one reason or another, but now it's 1 year after, and reunification is almost going to be a fact.
Mm-hmm. I think that's developed in a very natural way. When we were in Hanoi and asked questions about that, people were very hesitant to make any predictions. They didn't know themselves how difficult the reintegration of their country would be, how hard it would be to wash away the divisions and hostilities of 2 decades, close to 3 decades of civil war. The first steps that happened involved fairly large population movements between North and South, that is, members of families were encouraged to either go north or go south mm-hmm. to find their relatives. And that was limited by their logistical limitations, but in a very real sense, the first months after the end of the war were getting to know each other again mm-hmm. and essentially discovering that there was still more holding them together as one country than keeping them apart.
What were some of the differences, that were perceived between North and South Vietnam?
Well, it's...
The fact that there was a hostile government in Saigon, but, what were the difficulties that they foresaw, say, projecting that the provisional government would take in control eventually?
I was surprised when I visited North Vietnam. I've traveled in third world countries a great deal, and I was surprised at the poverty in the North, not the personal poverty of beggars. You didn't see that at all, but you did see a spare society that had no luxuries, had very little advanced comforts of life. Had the necessities fairly well distributed for everyone in the society, but people had lived a hard existence during the war in the North, and it was very different from the consumer society that was subsidized by the United States in the South. It's the coming together of a society in which there was a social ethic that said that it was more important to have culture cultural institutions for everyone, to have schools and public health for everyone than it was for people to have cars or radios or lots of meat on the table. Coming together with a society which was almost notorious for the kind of the injustices and the wealth that a few people had, mm-hmm. and all of the problems of prostitution and drug addiction in the South. There was nothing comparable in the North.
I saw those contradictions as being barriers that might not be able to be, I guess, legislated in a sense, mm-hmm. as far as by a government decree that reunification was to take place.
Plus the unknown factor about how difficult it would be for hostility to be overcome. That's a, mm-hmm. Remember what happened after the American Civil War or after the American Revolution. The victors treated the vanquished rather harshly, and there were lots of Tories that had to leave the United States, I think proportionally far more than Vietnamese left Vietnam. And they were waving the bloody flag, if I remember my American history right, long after the Civil War in terms of rivalry and taking advantage of the defeated section of the country. So they weren't easy problems to anticipate solutions to.
Sophie, what kind of, if you could give us an idea, I don't know how much really is available to us as Americans, but perhaps much more to you as folks that have been involved and deeply in contact, but in terms of a unified government, what kind of structure, what kind of policy orientation do you perceive it taking on?
Well, one thing that Madam Bin has made clear in different interviews she's given to Westerners is that the South and the North will still follow, there'll be separate economic policies for the two zones just because they are so different, so that for a period anyway, small private enterprise will be encouraged in the South, that sort of thing. There won't be collectivization immediately. The problems in the South are just to get production going again. They don't have, they're not at a stage where they can worry about collectivizing people. They basically, they have to come up with farm implements, livestock, seed. They have to get the people back to the land and start farming it again. So economically, the two zones will still be fairly different for a long time to come.
You mentioned getting production going again, and I would imagine that to a large degree hinges is perhaps the wrong word, but is related to the kind of relationship that the government of Vietnam and the economic sector in the South will have to the United States, because of, over the years, the equipment, the resources and so on which exist in southern Vietnam, I have to keep saying that, in southern Vietnam, are U.S. parts and replacement and what have you. Isn't that a factor?
Yeah, that is a factor. For example, all the landing equipment at the Saigon airport are very sophisticated instruments supplied by the U.S. And when the war ended, there was no one left in Saigon who knew how to operate that stuff. Mm-hmm. So there must be a tremendous amount of that sort of thing, computers, and to a lesser extent, the cars and farm implements, although a lot of equipment always was supplied from Japan. And I think they're quite rightly going to make an effort to get supplies suitable to Vietnam, which are more likely to be made in Japan than in the U.S.
What has been happening in the past year regarding U.S. relations with the new government, and particularly in light of a new government coming into power now?
It depends what aspect of the U.S. you're speaking of. If you're speaking of the popular level or the public level, while there's been a great decline of interest naturally since the war ended, still lots of Americans, whether through the service committee or through a lot of other religious and civic groups involved in the Friendshipment Coalition, have been raising funds and providing humanitarian reconstruction aid to South Vietnam and to Laos. In the Congress, though the Congress has been very much more conservative this year on defense spending kinds of issues, they just several weeks ago finally passed legislation which would lift the U.S. trade embargo against Vietnam for at least 6 months. And that passage came despite very intense administration pressure, including what I think we now regard as a kind of phony offer from Secretary Kissinger to begin negotiations. And it was an offer that came at such a time as he was trying to derail the Bingham Amendment in the House, and was probably not very seriously meant, although Ronald Reagan is taking Ford to task for it. But the administration has been steadily hostile in every conceivable fashion. The latest of which is that the World Health Organization called a conference in Manila to discuss the war-caused health needs in North and South Vietnam, or Northern and Southern Vietnam. Things from the WHO report, problems like 4 of every 5 former Saigon soldiers had venereal disease, an incidence of tuberculosis that was one of the highest in the world, malaria increasing, about 500,000 drug addicts, one of the few nations in the world where leprosy is spreading and where bubonic plague can still be fatal. And these are all, according to the World Health Organization, war-caused health problems. The U.S. was invited to a conference in Manila at the end of March to discuss those and refused to attend. And that's consistent with the U.S. vetoing the Vietnamese membership in the United Nations. It's really astounding that in a way that they would have the gall to be the only country in the world to vote against Vietnamese membership in the United Nations. I mean, of all countries that the United States would cast that vote is just, you, well, it's hard to...
To put words to that after such a long and tragic involvement.
So that we find, I think, there are different ways of explaining it. It could just be that Ford and Kissinger had their egos damaged so much by seeing their policies collapse a year ago that they're unwilling to do anything of a reconciling nature. Or it could be that it's like Cuba 20 years ago, that the U.S. is doing everything in its power to try to isolate and make more difficult the situation of the new government in South Vietnam or the new unified Vietnam, so that Thailand and the Philippines and other countries in Southeast Asia don't see that as an example of a direction of economic growth or organization that they might themselves go. There are reports of some military opposition within southern Vietnam, and it's been charged that there's CIA involvement in that. You know, we don't have proof, and we may not have it for 20 years, given that. Till the next round of revelations come out.
Well, what other than government actions, which you say, I mean, as far as the administration is concerned, have been, to say the least, ignoring the situation, what has the American Friends Service Committee been doing regarding Vietnam? And perhaps also, what are programs which you yourself have been involved in, both of you?
Well, one thing that we've done is that Sophie has just completed a slideshow and a photo display based on the experience that she and the other AFSC staff had who remained in Saigon through the first several months of peace, which is available for groups to use for programs of almost any sort, or the display can be used in student unions or anywhere else that there's 100 feet of space to set it up. But it's 14 by 17 placards. The service committee has a variety of humanitarian aid programs that go to both sections of Vietnam and to Laos, and we hope someday to Cambodia as well. We
Which has been a struggle to maintain, though, in light of the administration's opposition.
Well, a struggle at one point to get to get to Vietnam. That is, they denied us licenses as they had never done before in the fall, and we received support from a large number of people on November 10th. There was a vigil at the White House. There were demonstrations in 50 cities. Finally, about 5,000 people donated over $50,000 for the goods that the United States was trying to stop from going to Vietnam, things like rototillers and fishnets. 4 days after those demonstrations, Kissinger announced we were going to get our licenses, so that he, of course, credited it to other factors, but we suspect that he was responding to the obviously absurd position they had gotten to.
What is happening specifically around the... Perhaps you could focus on this just as a sort of a final comment as far as what is happening on the 30th of April, on the Liberation Day for folks in the Philadelphia area.
In Philadelphia, at the Friends Center building, 1501 Cherry Street, there'll be an event, a kind of celebratory event of a year of peace at 8 p.m., and that'll include a premiering of the slideshow that Sophie did. And the display will be there, of course. And also there'll be several speakers whose names may be familiar to your listeners. Lisa Schiller, who was with the Philadelphia Resistance, is going to be reflecting some on what the peace movement meant in Philadelphia. Stuart Meacham, who formerly was a peace secretary in AFSC and also was a national leader in the peace movement during the big mobilizations, will be similarly reflecting on the national peace movement. Leon Tu of AFSC's staff, a Vietnamese woman, will be talking about post-war issues. And there will be Vietnamese music and some Vietnamese food, and a good time will be had by all. The public is invited. We're asking people, if they can do it, to bring a voluntary contribution of a children's sweater, size 5 to 12, and those sweaters will go along with the 12,000 sweaters that the service committee is about to ship to Northern Vietnam.
Sounds like a good way of celebrating a year of peace. I'd like to thank you both for joining us this afternoon. I've been talking with John McAuliffe and Sophie Quinn Judge, both of the American Friends Service Committee Indochina Program. I'm Steve Schick, and for Fresh Air, this is WUHY-FM, listener-supported radio in the Delaware Valley.